Hello there, this is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program.
It's the Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. John is out today taking a bit of a break. Well, we have a lot to talk about this Friday. We're going to try to answer the question, just how much of your brain do you actually use? You know that old saying, you only use 10% of your brain? We're going to actually talk to some neuroscientists about that. Also, the director of a new HBO documentary, Nixon by Nixon in His Own Words, joins us. And speaking of in your own words, we're going to talk about plagiarism. This after our partner, the New York Times, discovered that John Walsh, the junior senator from Montana, and a decorated Iraq War veteran, plagiarized a big part of his master's thesis from the Army War College. And we'll pause to consider how to cope when the news is just too bad to listen to.
My name is Ken. I'm calling from Tampa, Florida. When the news gets really grim, especially the way it's been lately, it makes me want to seek out a private island with no contact with civilization whatsoever.
This is Carolyn from Detroit, Michigan. To take my mind away from the grim news, I like to read gossip blogs. They're a great way to distract you, and they're always about news that's either funny, ironic, maybe not so ironic, and it's a great way to take your mind off of what's going on.
This is Michael from Bloomfield, New Jersey. Sometimes when it's very bad, I've just got to skip my traditional nightly viewing of The Daily Show and The Colbert Report. It's not funny. It's tragic.
So how do you cope? Tweet us at The Takeaway. Judging by all the responses so far, we know this is something that really does concern you. The number is 8778-MY-TAKE if you want to be part of this conversation. To the Middle East, where efforts are intensifying to bring about a ceasefire 18 days into the latest conflict, and the number of dead Palestinians now tops 800. Dozens of Israelis have died. And in Gaza and on the West Bank, the authorities are expecting huge protests on what some are calling a day of rage. Secretary of State John Kerry has been in the region trying to negotiate a temporary ceasefire. Almost 1 in 10 of the entire population in Gaza, meanwhile, are now thought to be seeking shelter in UN-run schools. But even there, people aren't safe. A strike on one school yesterday killed at least 10 people. And a United Nations relief official told our partner, The New York Times, that more than 70 of the agency's schools, hospitals, and offices in the region have been damaged. Christopher Gunness is director of advocacy and strategic communications at the United Nations Relief and Work Agency for Palestine Refugees. He's based in Jerusalem. Chris, welcome.
Thank you so much.
We didn't know too much yesterday in the aftermath of the attack that we're talking about, or the shelling of the school anyway, where the UN had its relief facility. What do you know now?
Well, we know that we gave the Israeli army the precise GPS coordinates of this facility, which was clearly marked with a blue United Nations flag. We know that for hours before the attack, we were on the phone to the Israeli army explaining exactly what was going on, explaining that hundreds of people, including women and children, had taken refuge in what was a UN-designated shelter. But we know also that the approval we were asking for a humanitarian pause, a ceasefire, if you like, a temporary local cessation of fighting so that we could evacuate civilians, that never came. The approval never came from the Israeli army. And sadly, we all know now the consequences of that.
And you have not heard an explanation from the IDF or other Israeli authorities as to how this occurred?
We've not, and that's why we're calling for an immediate and comprehensive investigation. When you have a situation where a UN school is hit in this way, a school which has been designated as a shelter, then there has to be an investigation. I'm not pointing the finger of blame at the IDF, and I'm not pointing it at anyone. I'm saying there are questions that need to be answered. Why was it that so many people, women and children, were lost? Why was it that parents were forced through the indignity of having to scoop up the body parts of their children in a UN playground? There are so many unanswered questions, and we hope that these unanswered questions will be given an answer, because what the victims need most of all and first and foremost is information. When you're going through the kind of profound shock and grief that these people are going through, the first thing you need to put back together your shattered life is the truth. And once you've learned the truth, you can begin to put your life back together again. So we owe it to the people in Gaza who've suffered such an extraordinary indignity. We owe it to them to find out the truth.
Let me play a voice that's going to be familiar to you, Chris. This is Bob Turner. He's head of the UN Relief and Works Agency, your boss, who is in Gaza.
It's a human tragedy, and the number, you know, is not irrelevant, but it's less important. You know, we can't get stuck on the number. Right? These were human tragedies. These are lives that have been lost. These are families whose history has been altered. These are we need to focus on that. You know, whether it was 10 or it was 15, one is too many.
Chris Gunness, there have been previous ground incursions, previous confrontations, of course, between the Israelis and Hamas in Gaza. And this is not the first time that something like this has happened.
Absolutely not. It's a very good point. There's a long history. First of all, the immediate history. Just this week, there have been three occasions before this awful attack of UNRWA facilities taking direct hits from Israeli air power. We had a school with about 1,000 people in it being hit with air fire directly, and five people were injured. We had another school where there were 300 people taking a direct hit and a little girl was injured. When we went back to investigate, although we had arranged with the Israeli army a two-hour window, my colleague, a colleague of mine, was nearly killed because there was incoming fire, we believe, from the Israeli side. But let's go back even further to January 2009, when UNRWA facilities, which were full of displaced people, took direct hits, most notably our main headquarters in Gaza, where our warehouse was hit directly with white phosphorus and burnt to the ground. Israel apologized and paid millions in compensation, but that's not good enough. We need to have a situation where all the parties. And by the way, I include the militant groups because on two occasions recently, we have found that they secretly hid rockets in empty UN buildings. And we discovered this as a result of our own checks. We obviously came out publicly and condemned it. We've been very transparent about this. But we call on both warring parties to respect the sanctity of civilian life, the inviolability of UN premises, and also their international humanitarian law obligations towards humanitarian workers. We've lost three members of staff, not in that attack yesterday, but that is simply unacceptable.
That may be a key point, what you just mentioned, Christopher Gunness. You said that you've discovered instances of Hamas or other militants hiding weapons in your buildings.
Absolutely, but that still does not excuse this kind of firing. And I'm not saying it was Israeli firing, but the fact that there were militants there, there were hundreds of people, including women and children. That must not be forgotten.
What's next for you if your sanctuary facilities are coming under fire and they're turning deadly? What can your agency do from here going forward?
We have a situation right now where 140,000 people and rising, that's about 10% of the population of Gaza, have taken refuge with us. And today we are appallingly worried in the light of yesterday's attack that, frankly, we cannot offer them safe sanctuary.
Christopher Gunness is Director of Advocacy and Strategic Communications at the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees. He's in Jerusalem. Chris, thank you for your time.
My pleasure, anytime.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The internet has had a profound impact on the rate of student plagiarism. Studies prove it. From high school to graduate school, the impulse to copy and paste a sentence here, a paragraph there, even a page, has only grown over the last decade. Even top government officials are at it.
The notion that every thought or notion or idea you'd have to go back and find and attribute to someone, I think is, quite frankly, ludicrous.
Maybe so, 1988 Joe Biden, except you did apologize and acknowledge plagiarism back then. I guess things turned out okay for him. But this week, our partner, The New York Times, discovered that John Walsh, the junior senator from Montana and a decorated Iraq War veteran, plagiarized a big part of his master's thesis, a paper required to receive his advanced degree from the U.S. Army War College. That was back in 2007. Well, while the college plans to do a big investigation, the truth is that some of our most esteemed writers have confessed to plagiarism in the past, and many of them have maintained illustrious careers since those accusations. It's not necessarily a career record. Physics professor Lewis Bloomfield has encountered many plagiarized papers in his tenure at the University of Virginia, and he says in the age of the internet, plagiarizing is just all the more tempting.
There's so much stuff that just seems to be out there as though no one ever wrote it. It's just available. And it's a big temptation for students who are looking more for degrees than for an education.
What are your thoughts when you read about a prominent person, not a well-known senator, but a senator nonetheless, Senator John Walsh from Montana, and you see prominent people who are in the public eye get caught? Is it different than when a hapless undergrad gets caught?
I don't think it's very different. I think it's just a sad story all around.
Now, there's a lot of evidence in some studies to show that a lot of this is being, you know, driven by the internet, and that's not hard to see why. It's easy to post papers online. There are services that let you, that help you anyway, plagiarize, and it's just easy to download and very tempting. But I've always wondered, Professor, you know, if it's so easy to plagiarize because of the internet, it's got to be just as easy to catch people because, you know, you could enter in what they've written and let the internet do the searching for you and see how much of it's original. And I guess I'm not the first person to think of this.
That's right. It's a big arms race, really. It's easy to copy stuff. In fact, it appears on your computer as though it were yours, right? And so you just cut and paste if you're subject to that temptation. But on the other hand, you can use computers to find the same stuff. So it goes back and forth. In fact, I wrote software a long time ago to find plagiarism in my students' work. And it's been downloaded now maybe a million times, and I'm sure that some of those downloads are by people who are trying to make sure that they won't get caught rather than trying to find their own misbehavior.
Well, take us back to the year 2000, to your class. What happened and what led you to write a program to help you catch cheaters?
Well, I'd been teaching a very large introductory physics class for a long time at that point, and I'd been receiving term papers for several years by way of the internet. So I had electronic versions, copies of these papers in my collection. And a student came to me very upset that two of her friends had gotten higher grades than she had on papers they had not written, that they had recycled from previous semesters. That was news to me. It was pretty upsetting, but she wouldn't tell me their names. Finding the people who had done it was impossible. It's a needle in a haystack problem. So I wrote quickly, slapped together a program to try to find pairs of papers that shared similarities, and ran it over a weekend. And lo and behold, it didn't just find her two friends. It found a whole lot of recycling of papers. And it was a sad, disappointing experience. But okay, I went through it all. And 2 years later, about 50 students had left the University of Virginia, either admitting guilt or being found guilty in an honor trial, or ultimately having their degrees revoked in a couple of cases.
So we've talked a little bit about the internet, Professor Bloomfield, and of course it's easy to see why the internet expands a crime of opportunity, because there's just more stuff out there, so easy to download and appropriate. But what about sort of the quality diminution effect? Do you suspect that, sorry to sound old, but the online culture has led to poorer writing, that in addition to a crime of opportunity might, you know, increase the desire to get some decent writing down on paper?
I think the internet really has injured education in many respects. The problem that it's created for me in particular, and for many people like me, is that it's easier now to sort of assemble a paper out of pre-digested materials that you can find on the internet. So rather than spending 90% of your time thinking and 10% writing the paper, well, now it's reversed. Now you spend about 90% of your time finding great references on the web and 10% assembling a paper out of them. And the extent to which you sort of rethink the pre-digested material is where the education comes in. But really, the whole exercise isn't very valuable anymore. I've often joked to my students that if I just had a paper shredder up there at the front of the room when they turned in papers, 95% of the educational experience would already have been accomplished as they fed their paper into the shredder. It's not the reading or the grade that matters. It's the doing.
You know, I want to ask you about consequences, Professor Bloomfield. We just heard a clip from Joe Biden, who admitted to plagiarism at an earlier point in his career when he was a senator, plagiarism when he was younger. It didn't hurt his career at all. Look, the guy never became president, but he's done pretty well. Do you think students perceive consequences? Have they seen enough examples of people's careers ruined by this type of behavior?
I think that the very small number of people who get caught plagiarizing is hardly discouraging to the people who plagiarize. I think, first of all, plagiarism is sort of a crime of opportunity and often not planned well in advance. It's done for expedience, just trying to get the degree or even just to get the grade for the current paper. So they're not planning ahead. And they certainly don't look off into the future at the long-term consequences. And they probably don't even identify themselves so much as plagiarists. They kind of feel like, well, you know, the material's kind of out there. It doesn't belong to anybody. It's a victimless crime. So why be worried about it? And another thing about plagiarism is that it's really lives only in the world of the academy and things related to the academy, like scholarly books. Outside of the academy, plagiarism isn't really discouraged. It might even be okay. Business is full of plagiarism, people taking things that they didn't write themselves and presenting them as though they did. And even politics, look at politics. Lincoln wrote his own Gettysburg Address, or so we know, but most politicians don't write their own material, and they present it as though it were their own thoughts and are quite willing to take credit for having said it. So I don't know, plagiarism is kind of a grayscale problem in this world. Context matters, and some plagiarism no one really cares about.
Professor Lewis Bloomfield, professor of physics at the University of Virginia. Thank you, sir.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
It is estimated most human beings only use 10% of the brain's capacity. Imagine if we could access 100%. Interesting things begin to happen.
There's Morgan Freeman's character in the new sci-fi thriller Lucy, starring Scarlett Johansson, that's coming out in theaters today. Hey, when Morgan Freeman says something like that in a movie, you just believe him. Such authority. Well, we've been hearing about this 10% of your brain number. God, I've been hearing it since I was a kid, and it makes us wonder, 90% of your brain untapped, is that really our full mental potential? Does Scarlett Johansson, is she really onto something in this movie? Well, with me to dive into the actual neuroscience of the brain, the 10% of your brain, Sam McDougall, PhD student in psychology and neuroscience at Princeton University. He's been spending a lot of time looking into that 10% claim, and he's written about it in The Atlantic. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Todd. How are you?
Diagnosis. How much of my brain am I using right now?
I will diagnose you. The easy answer, 100%, Todd. Congratulations.
That doesn't feel like it.
But... right. The more complicated answer, though, actually, is that, of course, the brain's a biological organ, and so 100% is the correct figure. Like any organ, like your spleen or your liver, all the cells are doing something. DNA is being transcribed, proteins are being made, ions are being moved in and out, et cetera, et cetera. But, of course, like anything in science, the answer is more complicated. If all of your neurons were firing, if 100% of your neurons were firing all at once, you'd be having the biggest seizure in the history of mankind. So, of course, the answer is more complicated.
Well, where does this old cliche come from? I know it goes back to some old writings and assertions in kind of philosophical books, but the idea is that we don't live up to our potential.
I think, yeah. So it's hard to trace these myths. It's almost impossible. The best evidence seems to be in Dale Carnegie's 1936 self-help Bible, How to Win Friends and Influence People. The foreword there was written by Lowell Thomas, known for making T.E. Lawrence famous, actually. And he said, he misquotes William James, the Harvard psychologist, for saying we have unused mental potential. And Thomas said something along the lines of 10% of our mental potential is unused. And I think that's probably the best candidate for the origin of the exact 10% myth.
And so, like most cliches, it's kind of, you know, stuck around in spite of itself. And, you know, it's just very interesting how the 10% number is a proxy, isn't it? We always tell ourselves you can do more. As smart as you think you are or as hard as you're trying, you can always do more. It's more of a philosophical statement than a neuroscience statement, I guess.
Yeah, or even a pop psychology statement. You know, you think of those cat posters with the little hang in there kitty cat hanging from the tree. I think it's in that genre of you can do it kind of language.
And yet it's pretty clear, even from a neuroscientific perspective, you said 100%, you know, every part of my brain is active. But there are also lots of ways to increase neuron activity, to increase activity in the synapses when you get down to the spaces between cells, right?
Sure. I mean, activity can be altered by a number of things. And it's not just activity that matters. There's other things that matter. There's efficiency. And most importantly, what really is going on when you're, let's say, getting better at a musical instrument is you're increasing connections between certain assemblages of neurons. So to think of the brain as, to think of being better at something as being using more of your brain is a sort of false way to think of the brain. It's more using the brain in a more efficient way to do a given task.
Still, Sam McDougall, if it makes us strive, if we think that we've got 90% still ahead of us, it's worth it, right?
Sure, why not?
Why not? Sam McDougall is serious about how much of the brain we actually use. Sam McDougall is a PhD student in psychology and neuroscience at Princeton University. He uses 100% of his brain.
Always,
Sam, thank you.
Always 100. Thanks, Todd.
On August 9th, 1974, just about 40 years ago, President Richard Nixon resigned, the first U.S. president to do so. He was facing almost certain impeachment for his involvement, of course, in the Watergate scandal. And the most damaging evidence implicating Nixon was on those 3,700 hours of tape recorded by Nixon himself between February of 1971 and July of 1973 in the Oval Office and other rooms in the White House, and of which only three Nixon staff members knew anything about.
All files, any correspondence or anything that has to do with between me and any member of my staff belongs to the president, not to them. It's not their files, goddammit, they're mine. I'm not going to have these men treated like criminals, or goddammit, I'll fire this whole staff. You understand that?
That is the president of the United States using some pretty salty and nasty language there, speaking to his special assistant Stephen Bull in the wake of the early Watergate revelations. Nixon was an intolerant and paranoid and even racist man, and that's not news to most of us. But a new documentary airing on HBO on August 4th lets Nixon tell the story all by himself. It's called Nixon by Nixon, in his own words. It's directed by Peter Coonhart. On Coonhart's research team was historian Ken Hughes, the author of the forthcoming Chasing Shadows, The Nixon Tapes, The Chanel Affair, and The Origins of Watergate. Now, I sat down with both Peter and Ken for an inside look at the man behind those tapes and behind all the secrets.
He thought he could get away with it. He was not the first president to secretly record White House conversations. He was at least the fifth and probably the last. But Nixon was able to keep his taping secret and had every reason to think that those tapes would remain in his possession and in his control forever. If not for Watergate making them into criminal evidence, he would have gotten away with it.
And he probably never would have resigned.
Correct. He could have blamed it on his closest aides. And without the evidence that's on these priceless recordings, there would have been reasonable doubt in the minds of members of Congress and in the minds of the American people.
Well, Peter Coonhart, you give a fair amount of attention in your HBO documentary to the Pentagon Papers and Daniel Ellsberg. And of course, it's right over the middle of the plate when you think about what we're facing now with the revelations from Edward Snowden and NSA spying. A lot of the people use the Pentagon Papers and Ellsberg as the heroic antecedent if they are Snowden supporters. Well, let's listen to Richard Nixon in his own words first, talking about Daniel Ellsberg right around the time the Pentagon Papers were released.
We've got to go gung-ho now on this Ellsberg. You make a martyr out of him when we're going to give an incentive to every little son of a bitch in this government to run out of the place and rat on us.
Yeah, I think he took it very personally. He objected on privacy grounds, but he viscerally objected on personal grounds. It was an affront to his power. It was a challenge to him. And he didn't want anyone to get away with this. And I think the fact that he does go after Ellsberg in such a kind of visceral, personal way, it's indicative of his strategy, how to stop something from getting beyond his control.
And Nixon was afraid. He was worried that people would find out about the secret bombing of Cambodia. And I think he was worried about people finding out about what he had done in 1968 in order to win the election by sabotaging Lyndon Johnson's peace talks in Vietnam.
The day the Ellsberg tape story broke, it was the same day as his daughter's wedding was on the front page of the New York Times. And Nixon was basking in the glow of the good press he got for the wedding. And the calls that came in to tell him about the papers, he really didn't quite understand it at first. He didn't know what the repercussions would be. He didn't quite grasp it. And his aides, in numerous conversations, built it up and almost kind of whipped him into a frenzy about it.
And the Ellsberg affair, you know, it struck me, is really the epicenter of all of the different things that seemed to concern Nixon during the time these tapes were being made. His loathing of the press, Vietnam, his anti-Semitism, his paranoia, and Watergate all kind of center around that one leak of the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times, and Nixon seemed to kind of know it.
We must keep up the attack on the media. You've got to keep destroying their credibility. There's not a good one on the whole goddamn free network, not one.
Yes, and I think this was a moment when Nixon felt threatened in every way. He felt threatened with exposure with regard to secrets involving Vietnam. And he went to desperate lengths involving this conspiracy theory that people were going to, you know, start with the Pentagon Papers and then move on to leaking his secrets. And that led him to create the Plumbers, the secret unconstitutional police unit that he operated out of the White House. And, of course, assembling that team inadvertently brought together the team that ultimately masterminded the Watergate break-in.
Well, let's listen to a younger Senator Ted Kennedy and Nixon's reaction. Listen.
We know that thousands of soldiers of North and South Vietnam and tens of thousands of innocent men and women and children will die in Indochina in 1972 for the simple reason that President Nixon will not allow the Saigon government to falter until he is secure at home for another term of office.
Mr. Christ, they could get at that, get at Kennedy, though. And I mean, that's another bit. Jesus Christ.
He really is. There is a man totally without scruples, Kennedy.
He's got smart little kikes working for him.
Well, they've been pumping him up.
Yeah, I, there's no defending the language and the characterizations and the descriptions he uses against all kinds of people. In this case, he's sitting with Chuck Colson, who brought out the worst in Nixon. Chuck Colson was his master at dirty tricks. But more than that, Kennedy was a symbol of a popular politician that Nixon simply couldn't seem to get there.
Richard Nixon, for all of the faults that we've talked about, and they are many and they are deep, isn't the first politician to be a shapeshifter, depending on who he was talking to, is not the first president to be an anti-Semite and a racist, or to be conspiratorial, or to grab power, or to break the law, frankly. Is that Nixon's entire legacy at this point? Are we missing anything about the president who is effective in some ways? I mean, they're both fair, maybe.
Nixon just becomes more interesting the more you get to know him, because the greatness that Nixon created is real. Everyone knew Nixon was a startlingly intelligent president, but he's even smarter behind the scenes than he is in public. He knows exactly what he's doing, and yet running through all these grand moves like the opening to China and the first nuclear arms control agreement with the Soviet Union is the most petty political calculation and the most small-minded bigotry that you can imagine. And so the more you get to know about Nixon, just the more interesting and complex he becomes.
Ken Hughes is a historian and author of the forthcoming book Chasing Shadows, The Nixon Tapes, The Cheneaux Affair, and The Origins of Watergate. And Peter Coonhart is director of HBO's new documentary, Nixon by Nixon, in his own words. It's fascinating. Peter and Ken, thank you both.
Thank you so much for inviting us.
Is there anything on the news except bad news and tragedy and more bad news? It's been one of those weeks where that bad news just keeps piling on.
146 Palestinian children.
Fighting in Syria has escalated dramatically.
Malaysia Airlines lost contact with Ukraine air traffic control.
And for a number of you, it was all too much, and you turned it off.
I tend to be an anxious person anyway, and with everything going on in the world, on top of the usual pressures of life, it's just overwhelming. And for me, it magnifies other stresses in my life. I want to stay informed, but sometimes need to know when to turn the news off.
We asked you how you turn it all off, and you gave us your serenity secrets.
I'm Barbara Smith from Sag Harbor, New York. When things get really grim, I just try to keep going to yoga class. It leaves me with a sense of peace and hope. And I like to spend time with young children because they're always unburdened by the world's events.
Deep breaths. That was the common theme that we heard.
My name is Bruce from Tallahassee, Florida. At times like these, I just remember that I cannot do squat about all the stuff that happens around the world or even in my little hometown. And I try just to resolve yet again to enjoy every day as much as I can. And a little bourbon doesn't hurt either.
Oh, it's true. A little bit of bourbon never hurts. Well, John Cassidy, a staff writer at The New Yorker, found himself trying to figure out how to stop watching all the bad news when it followed him along on vacation recently. He reflected then on the value and some of the shortcomings of a news blackout, and you can read that piece at thenewyorker.com. Hi, John.
Hi there, Todd.
John, you write that on your recent vacation you visited a friend and that she was experimenting with a complete news blackout, sort of out of frustration, I guess. Explain.
Well, yeah, she said she just couldn't take the news anymore, which is hardly surprising. I mean, with what we've seen this summer, you know, what's happening in the Ukraine, Gaza, Syria, Iraq. And she's in the media business, too. So I was up in Vermont for a week trying to get away from it all, but not really successfully because I still had my phone with me, so I had access to all the news. On our way back down to New York City, we stopped in the Hudson Valley to have dinner with his friend, and turns out she was having what she called a complete news out. She turned her phone off. She didn't have internet access. She didn't have newspapers. She wasn't even watching TV. She was just going completely cold turkey for a month because she basically just got so stressed out about everything. She said she needed a rest.
And the consequences of that you talk about, because on the one hand, it's completely understandable, probably healthy to disengage when you feel like there's nothing but bad news. Totally makes sense. On the other hand, you warn that isolating ourselves from bad events or thinking that we can keep total distance sort of absolves us from responsibility that we have to take for the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sort of two-sided thing. Obviously, from a sort of individual perspective, and my friend's completely right. I mean, I feel the same way. I've been covering the news every day. You do need a break. I mean, how many pictures of sort of kids being blown up in schools can you watch before it starts to affect you? So on an individual basis, I think it's completely rational and sensible and morally right to take a break every now and again for a week or whatever and just go away and spend time with your family, read books, do whatever the heck you want and just tune out. But of course, if everybody does that all the time, then there are big consequences because the journalism and the public are really the only check on events in the world. I mean, I think it would be disastrous if we all tuned out completely and said, well, we just don't care what happens in the Ukraine. We just don't care what happens in Gaza. We just don't care what happens in Syria or Iraq. And being part of the United States, which, you know, the United States is not just a small country where our actions and influences don't matter. We still do matter. We're the only superpower left. So if anybody can influence things, it's us.
You talk about Thomas Hobbes in your piece and say that we're in sort of a Hobbesian moment when it comes to our news consumption and world events. What did you mean?
Well, Thomas Hobbes was the English philosopher who is known for his saying that, you know, life used to be nasty, brutish, and short, and he's sort of the philosopher of power and militarism, is how he's been interpreted. It seems to me that's the way, just this summer anyway, the world appears to be going. I mean, I go back a long way covering U.S. politics. I was in Washington in the late 80s when, which is a much more hopeful moment, George H.W. Bush was talking about a new world order. Francis Fukuyama, the head of policy planning at the State Department, wrote a book about the end of history in which he said that, you know, liberal Western values, peace, commerce, democracy were triumphing or had triumphed. Now, 25 years later, it looks like the opposite is happening. Fukuyama was a big fan of John Locke, the Enlightenment philosopher, who, you know, was a sort of one of the great believers in progress. It's a lot harder to believe in progress this year. And, you know, it seems Hobbesian to me. I mean, if you look at some of the individual events, Vladimir Putin to me seems like he's a classic Hobbesian. The Israeli administration adopting a very Hobbesian sort of strategy in Gaza using the sort of policy of might is right and establishing facts on the ground. It just seemed to me to be a sort of Hobbesian, chaotic, horrible moment.
You know, John Cassidy, I was thinking when I read your piece how often people say to me, oh, you cover politics, it's useless and it's gridlocked. Don't you get sick of it? Aren't you beaten down? And I say, yeah, you know, sometimes I am, but the best thing for corrupt politicians or powerful people or entrenched interest is when they think no one's watching.
No, I think that's completely right. I mean, I'm a journalist. I cover this stuff every day. And you have to believe that journalism does have some impact. And it's not just journalism. These days, because of social media and the internet, regular people can have more of an impact. I mean, I think it does matter how people react on Twitter and Facebook and things. Maybe not immediately, but, you know, I think the sort of world outrage over the Malaysian airline downing is having some impact. Vladimir Putin seems to be sort of rethinking things a bit. Hasn't been much impact so far in Israel-Gaza, but although I think the sort of mass outrage at the civilian killings has prompted John Kerry to get on a plane and try and produce some sort of a ceasefire. If we all just disengage and say, you know, it's nothing to do with me, I'm just going to go to the countryside and tune out, I think the consequences would be disastrous.
John Cassidy writes for The New Yorker and writes about why it's okay to tune out from the news. Sometimes you have to, but the disengagement can mean isolationism, and that's something that none of us can really afford. John Cassidy writes on TheNewYorker.com this week. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
This is Renee Downing. I'm calling from Charleston, South Carolina. We watch just enough news to stay informed, and Turner Classic Movie Channel is a great escape to simpler times.
This is Adam Isley from Chatham, Illinois. When the news cycle gets too depressing, escapism is the route I like to take. Dungeons & Dragons is an old pastime. Fifth edition's coming out this summer. Pretty excited.
Glenn from the Bronx in New York escapes the headlines by turning on sports radio. He says, often inane, occasionally offensive, but almost never grim. And in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, I listen to the news so I can stay informed about what's going on in the world. But if I can't do anything about it, I remind myself about what's going on well in my own life and the world. I don't watch the 10 p.m. news, only the weather. Nothing I can do about the news of late, and I can get to sleep to be better prepared for the next day. And when all else fails, Dave from Tigard, Oregon says, I go fishing. How do you cope with bad news? Our number is 8778-MY-TAKE. You can send us a tweet at The Takeaway. And as John Cassidy just said, regular people can make an impact. If you want to do something for people caught up in conflicts in the Middle East, we've posted links and resources for humanitarian agencies online at thetakeaway.org. Thank you so much for listening to our bad news, but also our good. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.